You're not gonna give up, are you?
If I'm gonna do it, I was kicked off every team I was ever on before I even got a chance to prove myself.
This way I need my own moment.
It's a world that doesn't want to know you.
So what's new?
I know what it's like to be written off.
I can get you your moment. It's gonna hurt like hell.
We have no desire to be associated with ludicrous antics.
I think a little bit of weed came out.
And defeat.
You're a disgrace to the sport.
Really?
Personal best! And we're a disgrace!
I love proving people wrong.
I have to do this.
You got more spirit than any of those other jumpers out there.
Here he comes, Britain's Eddie Edwards.
You're Eddie the Eagle.
Just fly.
Eddie's off.
Can he pull off the impossible?
The movie Eddie the Eagle. But what's the true story of a builder and a plasterer from Gloucestershire who went to the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary and competed in ski jumping? My guest this week is Eddie the Eagle Edwards. I'm Graham Mack. This is London Calling. This week in Britain, we honoured another hero with a bravery award for a little girl who called emergency services when her mum collapsed after having an epileptic fit.
Mum, I wake my mum up when she's not waking up.
Right, okay, is she breathing?
I don't know because I can't make her up.
Okay, is she conscious?
Her head spins around and she goes forward on the bottom floor.
Right,
stop. My number is...
Hang on. What I need you to, what, now, hello, what I need you to do, okay, is just stay on the phone for me. It's really important, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, is she breathing noisily?
I think she is.
Okay, right, tell me exactly what's happened.
She's fallen on the floor, and she spins her head around, and then she falls down onto the floor.
Okay. Is there an adult there with you?
No.
Okay. What's the full address of the emergency? What's your home address?
She's shaking.
That's okay. What's the full... Where do you live? What's the full address of the emergency? What's your house number? Which town or city is that in?
Derby.
Derby. Okay. Right. Stay on the line for me. How old is your mum?
I don't know.
That's okay. All right. Is she awake?
No.
Right, okay. How far did she fall?
Really far, because she's really big.
What's your name?
Lily May.
Okay, how old are you?
Six.
You're 6 years old, okay. Okay. And you're there by yourself, are you, with your mum?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, just go to your front door, where you'd let the people in. You've got to let the ambulance people in. Hello, is the ambulance people there?
Yeah.
They're there with you? Okay, go and show them where your mummy is. Are the people there with you now? Are the people from the ambulance there with you?
Yes.
All right, okay, you've done a smashing job, okay? We'll help her, okay? Now, I'll leave you with the help, okay? Thank you.
Isn't that great? 6-year-old Ellie May. She knew exactly what to do. She knew the number to call. She could tell them her address, and emergency services came round. May have just saved her mum's life. Her mum, Portia, has made a full recovery. Ellie May received a bravery award this week in London from the emergency services. So on the radio, I asked the question, when have you had to call the emergency number, and what was the emergency? I heard from Donna, who had to call our emergency number, 999, who decided to send out the Air Ambulance, which is a rescue helicopter.
About 6-7 weeks ago, for my 12-year-old daughter, she had a freak accident on a horse and she fell off.
Goodness me.
But unfortunately, the horse sort of like stood on the side of her face and actually sort of like pulled a good part, you know, a good proportion of her ear off.
Wow.
Also, obviously, we had to do a 999 call and we had the ambulance turn up, but also we had the air ambulance involved as well.
Yeah.
They turned up. Also Prince William turned up as well, which was something we never expected.
He was the pilot of the air ambulance, was he?
He was, yeah.
Wow.
So that was all a little bit, yeah,
that's quite the day. Now, what's your daughter's name?
Her name's Holly.
And is Holly okay?
Yeah, she's absolutely fine. We went to Lister Hospital. I mean, absolutely fantastic there. And then she went into plastics surgery, and they sort of like reattached all the ear and that for her. She's absolutely fine. She's back riding a horse and having lessons and loving her to bits. You know, I'm really proud of the fact that she's actually got back on the horse and that she does that now.
Oh,
but
good for
also
her.
For the fact that the the ambulance services and everything else are absolutely fantastic, and the hospital are absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Because she was in a state.
Yeah.
And I can't thank them enough, to be fair.
Now, Prince William gets a bit of stick. They're saying it's not a real job and he's not really doing much.
Oh, no, he was. He got involved. He spoke to my daughter, helped with the spinal board and everything. Put a blanket on. Yes, he did get involved. You know, obviously we didn't speak to him, but he did get involved with my daughter.
Well, he's busy.
He's and everything.
Well, now, hey, Holly's got a story now. Prince William saved my life. That's a pretty good story, isn't it? Prince William saved my life.
It is a really good story, but the only one letdown, like he always do, when she got to the hospital and everyone already knew that he'd been involved with it.
Yeah.
My daughter turned and she said, I don't really like Prince William. She said, I like Prince Harry better.
Well, there's no pleasing some people.
I know.
Donna, thanks for sharing.
Okay, thanks ever so much.
So, Holly was rescued by the wrong prince. Prince William is one of the pilots of the air ambulance that flies out of the east of England. Holly might have actually missed her chance with Prince Harry. Reports this week that he's got a new girlfriend, and she's American. According to the Mail Online, Harry is besotted with the Suits actress, Meghan Markle. We'll have to keep our eye on this one and see how far it goes, because last time one of our royals married an American, it caused an abdication. That was back in 1936, when Edward VIII abdicated the throne so he could marry the American socialite Wallis Simpson. Let's go to America now. Charles listens to the show in Chicago. You discovered me when you heard me as a guest on the Jonathan Brandmeier show. And you've actually been to London.
I was just there a week, which was more than enough for me to love the city. It's just amazing. Buddy of mine, I'm trying to remember all the crazy places that I went, did the double-decker bus tour, ate at a very fancy restaurant, I can't remember the name at the moment, and just enjoyed exploring. Yeah, everybody there was just delightful and fun. The thing I enjoyed was the train, or the tube, I guess it's called.
Yeah.
People were warm, chatty, and very helpful. You know, I had no idea where to go, so some people would actually get off the train and point me where to go. I just enjoyed the warmth and the kindness of the people in general.
That's good to know, because I found Chicago very friendly. Somebody described Chicago as like New York, but with nice people. I forget who that was, and I really apologize to anyone listening in New York right now, but if you want a rebuttal, you know how to get a hold of me, just send me an email. It's graham@macmedia.co.uk. But that was how it was explained to me. And Chicago's a strange place because you've got a concrete beach.
Yes.
Well, what's that all about?
I guess they dumped rubble and other things there just to build a barrier towards the lake. From my knowledge that I remember, is the part of the city was actually underwater, and they just built up the city and just poured sand and concrete and all this other crazy stuff. But yeah, there's a what I call rebar beach that, you know.
What do you call it?
I call it rebar beach.
Rebar, as in reinforced concrete, reinforcement
yeah.
beach.
So Rebar Beach, and people like they hang out at the beach, don't they? And like it's a real beach.
Yes, they do.
When I was in Chicago, there was a comedian at the convention I was at, and I forget her name. And she's probably very famous in America, but I forget her name. And she was talking about the concrete beach in Chicago, and she was saying, you know, you can see parents saying, don't swim too far out, stay nice and close in by the curb. I thought that was a nice line. Yes. I wish I knew her name. I've just stolen her joke.
Oh, my gosh.
So what would you say was the biggest culture shock then when you came over to Britain? What surprised you the most?
Well, what I found interesting was how similar most people sounded, except for in Cardiff. When I went to visit Wales and had the doctor who...
Oh, you went out and about. You got out of London. Wow, you're a brave man.
Oh.
You went to Wales.
Yes. Why
did you go there?
Because I wanted to go to the Doctor Who experience.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's where it is made. It's made in Cardiff. That's where they make the show.
I had no idea. No wonder the budget's so cheap.
What's that supposed to mean?
Nothing, sir. It shows that they are very frugal.
They are. South Wales, my wife's extended family are from South Wales. And I met my wife in New Zealand, and we moved to Australia together. And in 1997, we moved back to Britain. I'm originally from here. And we went to visit Julie's extended family. And they're like, oh, so you've been to New Zealand and Australia? And, you know, we'd already done a couple of trips to America by that stage, and I think it was one of her uncles, and he said, I've only ever been to the lighthouse. And I think the lighthouse is like a mile and a half from his house.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not fair to generalize, but I know what you mean. You get that feeling about South Wales.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, I've listened to Jonathan Brandmeier recently talking about the Chicago Cubs. Are they still doing well, and does that even interest you?
Oh, no, the Cubs. Oh, I'm the opposite. I am...
You're the opposite?
Yes, I'm a Sox fan, and we were fortunate enough to win first this century. And there is rumor that if the Cubs do win the World Series, it might be the sign of the beginning of Armageddon. So
okay.
Please be forewarned.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the warning. And on that, Charles, thank you so much for checking in. It's great to have you on London Calling.
Good fortune, and always remember you're loved.
Let's get to this week's guest. It's amazing how two films have been made about the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary. And neither of them were about winners. In the 80s, we had Cool Runnings, which was about the Jamaican bobsled team. And this year, Eddie the Eagle, about the British ski jumper, who came last in Calgary. Eddie's on the phone now from his home in Gloucestershire. And Eddie, the first time I saw you on TV, I lived in New Zealand with my wife, Julie. And we stayed at a motel that had a satellite dish that used to poach TV programs off American Armed Forces TV. And one night they were showing the Johnny Carson show. And you were the first guest. Do you remember that night?
Yeah, I do, of course.
But do you remember what you said to Burt Reynolds? What he said to you and what you said to him?
Yes, because I was explaining that I was trying to get to a press conference and that the guy, the security guard, wouldn't let me in because he said I didn't look like an athlete. And then when Burt Reynolds came out, he said, I think you look like an athlete. And then I turned around and said, well, I think you look like a movie star.
Absolutely brought the house down. And I'm like, I'm sitting there with my wife and watching it. This is Eddie the Eagle. I mean, I'd heard about you. But then I saw it on there and just thought it was amazing. What was that night like then?
Oh, it was incredible. You know, it was during the Olympic Games. I'd done the big jump, the big hill, and I had about 4 or 5 days before the closing ceremony. And then I got a phone call from the Johnny Carson show, and they said, we'd love to bring you down to L.A. And I said, yeah, okay. And I flew down to L.A. and met him and met Burt Reynolds and had a wonderful 2 days in Los Angeles, and then flew back to Calgary for the closing ceremony.
And Burt became a bit of a pal, didn't he?
He He was, yeah. He gave me his number because I was in the green room all afternoon with him chatting. And so we were together for about 4 or 5 hours before the show. And he invited me to his ranch in Florida, and he gave me the number of his ranch. I've still got it, actually, in my address book. And he's a lovely guy.
Did you ever go?
No, unfortunately, I was so busy. I was busy on my feet, literally didn't touch the ground for about 2 years. I was traveling all over the world doing lots and lots of different stuff. And I just didn't get a chance even to go for the weekend down to Florida to his ranch and meet him and spend a bit of time with him.
Well, I want to find out about some of the stuff you did when you came home after the Olympics in Calgary in 1988. But first things first, is it Eddie or Michael?
Eddie.
It is Eddie, but you were born and christened as a Michael.
Yes. No, I don't use Michael for my PR work at all. I try and avoid Michael completely because it just confuses people. So I much prefer to use Eddie when I'm doing PR and speaking and Eddie the Eagle work. And then I keep Michael for family and my building and plastering and things. And I try not to, combine the two, really. So even when I do TV shows and they say, we'd like to say Michael Edwards, I say, no, I'd rather you just use Eddie rather than use Michael as well. Because, it's nice to keep Michael just for me personally and for my family.
And where did Eddie come from?
Well, Eddie actually came from infant school. I went to infant school and they used to call me Ed because of Edwards, and then Ed went to Eddie and I was just known as Ed or Eddie. And then when I started skiing, I just used Eddie and not Michael at all, and that's what most people knew me as, and that's what I answered to. And and I've always kept Eddie. So most people, when they ask me who I am, I automatically say Eddie. But nowadays it's nice to, when I'm doing stuff that's not related to PR, then I've gone actually back to Michael. I mean, I dance a lot now, and when I go dancing and people ask me my name, I always say Michael now, not Eddie.
Talk me through what it's like then to ski jump at the Winter Olympics.
Wonderful. It was a dream of mine to get to those Olympic Games, and just to get to an Olympic Games was just incredible, because I never ever thought that I might make it. You know, I always dreamed and hoped that I would, and to finally, you know, get the nod and to go to the Olympic Games and take part in the whole thing was just an incredible feeling, and I was so happy and excited, and it was wonderful taking part, and the Calgarians really loved having the Olympics there, and they made us feel so welcome, and it was just one big party, really, for 2.5 weeks.
You grew up in Gloucestershire. Tell me about that. Typical family?
Yeah, typical family. I come from Cheltenham in Gloucestershire, and we have one of the biggest dry ski slopes in the country in Gloucester, and I learned to ski at Gloucester Ski Centre, went to school in Cheltenham, a little junior school, and then Norton Park Senior School, and then they invited me to go on my very first school ski trip, and it went from there. But I had a lovely childhood, great family, and I had lots of fun.
I know the film took a lot of artistic license, but the bit about you being a daredevil as a kid, that bit seemed like it was true. You are roughly the same age as me, so I'm guessing you were influenced by the likes of Evel Knievel.
Very much so, yes. We used to watch Evel Knievel on, World of Sport, or with Dickie Davis, World of Sport on Saturday.
Yeah.
And I used to watch the Speedway when they used to have Speedway on and all that kind of stuff. They had some really good, unusual sports. They used to show cliff diving from Acapulco and all that kind of stuff. And, as I grew up, if somebody dared me to do something, I would just jump in and do it. If they dared me to jump off that wall or jump out of a tree or try and climb the tree or climb scaffolding or jump off the garage roof onto a mattress or, things like that, I'd be the first to do it. And I loved it. And my mum and dad thought that as I grew up, I would grow out of it. But as I grew up, I got worse. And, skiing was actually good for me because, I could be as fast as I wanted to be. I could be as crazy as I wanted to be, so it kind of ticked all my boxes, really.
And at the age of 11, doctors thought you'd never be able to run or play sport again. What happened there?
Yeah, I had an infection in my cartilage, and I was in and out of hospital for about 2.5 years, and in and out of plaster, and found it very, very difficult you know, couldn't go to school much, and if I did, I was wearing a plaster cast, which made things really difficult. And yeah, it was good. And then all of a sudden it cleared up. And then when I wanted to go skiing, my mum and dad were a little bit nervous about it because of my knee. But I've never had any problems since with it. So, you know, I'm glad they had the courage to let me go on my ski trip and go from there. But the movie did it really well, because if they'd have put me in a plaster cast in the film, it could have implied that I just had an accident, when it was much more serious than that. So they put me in calipers. Although I didn't wear calipers as a child, I was in and out of plaster and in and out of hospital, but to sort of symbolise that, they used calipers. So the opening sequence where I was a little boy walking down the stairs in the film, and I've got those calipers on, you know, it wasn't quite like that, but I can see why they used that to symbolise the problems that I had with my knee.
And you weren't a well-off family by any means. I mean, you had a coin-operated television, but that got you into trouble with the police one day. Tell me about that.
That's right, yes, because we'd run out of coins to put in the back of the telly. So I was only about 4 or 5 at the time, and I rang the police and said, we can't watch telly. And the police came round, and then when my mum got home from work, because we used to leave school and go home, we were latchkey kids, so we had a key to the front door, and we'd get in, and we sort of look after ourselves until our mum came home from work. And then my mum came home and saw the police at our door, and she wondered what had happened. And then they were trying not to laugh, and they said, could you explain to your child that you don't ring the police just because you've run out of TV money for the television?
Well, when you're a kid and the TV won't work, that's an emergency, you know.
Well, it is. That's right. I mean, today it would be the equivalent of, I suppose, an iPhone or an iPad. And, yeah. You know, if that runs out, oh, my God, they go up the wall. And so, yeah, for us, it was the telly.
In your book, what really comes across is what a loving family you come from. But you do talk about times that your parents gave you, and I'm quoting, a belting. Was that a metaphor, or did they actually hit you with a belt?
No, they didn't hit me with a belt. My dad used a slipper, but it was only, I mean, I can only remember, I think, 3 times when I was hit with a slipper, because then it was serious, you know, really, really serious. We'd done something seriously wrong. And I remember the one time we got a slipper, both me and my brother, because I was 4 and I think my brother was 6, and we walked home from Tewkesbury, which is 9 miles. And we were with my dad on the building site, because he was looking after us. And this building site was right alongside the river. And we told our dad we were walking home. And of course, he just laughed and thought, yeah, right. And we decided to walk home. And then my dad was trying to look for us at the end of the day, the working day. Then he got very worried because of the river. He thought we might have fallen in the river. And then all of a sudden he got a phone call from the police to say, oh, your sons are at home. They walked home. And yeah, me and my brother walked home. And so we got the slipper for that, because that was very, very naughty. And then we had some money down in the cellar for the electric meter. And I found it one day and went out and bought a load of toys. And so I got the slipper for that as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's only when we were very, very naughty that we got that slipper.
You don't use the slipper on your daughters, do you?
No.
Okay. You talked about helping your dad out on the building site. What age were you when you left school yourself?
16/17.
And did you go and work for your dad straight away then?
Well, yeah, I worked with my dad in the building, in the plastering. You know, at weekends, on a Saturday, I would go and work with my dad, you know, at school holidays when we had 6 weeks, and earn a bit of pocket money. So that's how we did it. So I worked with my dad in the building from a very early age.
How did working on a building site prepare you to be an Olympic athlete?
Well, it's actually very good, because carrying buckets of sand and cement and bags of rubble and that kind of thing up and down the scaffold and filling the skip, you know, it made me very, very fit, and I was very, very strong. So consequently, at school, when we had things like athletics meetings, I was very good at things like the javelin, the shots, and the discus. Because I was very strong from working in the building, I could throw the discus and the shot much further than everybody else. So, you know, it was good for my, you know, general fitness, and especially for my skiing when I started skiing.
And Cheltenham isn't a ski resort. Most winters it might not even snow. How did you get into skiing?
I got into skiing from a school ski trip. I was invited to go when I was in the 3rd year at school. I was 13 years old. And my mum and dad decided that we could all go on a school trip. And for me, it was skiing. And we went to Andalou in the Italian Dolomites. But before we went, we went over to Gloucester Ski Centre, which was 10 miles away. We had 4 one-hour lessons and then went to ski in Andalou. Had a lovely time in Italy, in Andalou. And then when I came back, it became a regular thing. Every Sunday morning, I'd go skiing and my dad would take me. And then it became all-day Sunday. And then after a few weeks, it was all-day Saturday and Sunday. And then within about 3 or 4 months, skiing just took over my whole life. It was all I ever thought about, talked about, jumped about with skiing.
And it's a dry ski slope, so it's like bristles, isn't it, that you ski on? It's not actually snow.
That's right. It's what we call dry ski slope, but it's like toothbrush, but much stiffer. You know, it's great for racing on and great for skiing on, especially when at this time of the year when it starts to get cold and wet and damp. But if you fall over, it's very easy to break your fingers and thumbs, break your wrist and tear your clothing apart. So it does have its, downsides, but then you learn not to fall over. So it's good for your skiing too.
Eventually, though, you did get a job in an Italian ski resort. How did that happen?
Yeah, I left school at 16, 17, and my mum and dad wanted me to go into draftsman, be a draftsman, because I was very, very good at technical drawing. I used to design houses and all that kind of thing. But my heart really wasn't in it. I wanted to go skiing, and I applied for a job with a travel company as a ski mechanic. And because I worked at Gloucester Ski Centre, which helped pay my way, you know, pay for my skiing at Gloucester, because my mum and dad couldn't afford me to ski all the time at Gloucester Ski Centre, so I used to work there, which paid for my skiing. So because I was a good ski mechanic, they allowed me to go out and work for this travel company. And that was it. I went to Italy, and I went there for 3 seasons when I was 17, 18, and 19, and had a wonderful time. Learned very good Italian, and met lots of people, and had a fantastic time. And that was probably the best time of my life. I was skiing the whole season, all day, every day, and I got very, very fit, and I got very, very good at skiing.
And you were working as well. And what does a ski mechanic do?
As a ski mechanic, I would give all the boots out, the ski boots, to the clients, the holidaymakers that came out for a skiing holiday, and then fit their boots up to the skis to make sure that they would release if they fell over, and gave them their poles. So they'd go off skiing, and then I'd sort out any problems that they'd have while they're skiing that week. And then at the end of the week, I'd collect it all in and clean it, and then get it ready for the next day for the next holidaymakers that came out. So it was purely looking after ski equipment and that kind of thing. But I also did a bit of entertainment for them, because there was me and the rep and the ski instructor, so we all had to chip in with entertainment in the evening, be a judge in fancy dress or that kind of thing,
quiz nights and that. Yeah,
that's right. And had a fantastic time. I went out there a very, very shy boy, and then after the third year I came back a very confident young man.
And you came back, you worked on the building sites again, but then you competed in the UK as a downhill racer in skiing competitions on these dry ski slopes, and you became very good at that, didn't you?
Yes, because I was skiing all winter, so I'd be skiing for the whole winter. Then come when I came home in sort of April, May time, I would then do my racing circuit around the UK, because there used to be about 200, maybe 250 dry ski slopes around the country. So I would race, and then I built up amassed a lot of points, and then at 17, I got my international race license to race for Great Britain at slalom, giant slalom, downhill at 17, 18, and 19, and it was very, very expensive. But when I was working in Italy, I was doing all my training out there anyway, and if there was a race that was close enough, you know, I would go off and do a race. But otherwise, it was very, very difficult, because I was a very poor athlete. My mum worked in an office, my dad was a builder, we didn't have much money, but I did the best I could, you know, racing with what I had.
Well, you were England's young skier of the year. I mean, that's how good you were.
That's right, yes. I'd won the competition. It was a national competition, and I won it. So at I think I was 18 at the time. So at 18, I was the most technically precise skier in the UK, which was a lovely accolade. I've still got the cups and things like that to show. So, I've kept those. I was very proud of those.
Tell me about the support you got from your family, Eddie.
They were lovely. My mum and dad, you know, whenever they could, they would take me over to the ski slope because I wanted to be over there. If I wasn't at school, then I wanted to be at the ski slope. So whenever possible, I would ask my mum and dad to take me over there. Or I would ask, you know, people who I knew that were going out to ski over at Gloucester, I'd ask if they could come and pick me up and take me over there and bring me home. Or if I had a bike, I would cycle over there. And, you know, they did as much as they possibly could. They bought me my very first pair of skis, my mum and dad, a pair of Blizzard skis. And from those Blizzard skis, I won the Gloucestershire Open Championships and the Southwest Open Championships and all that kind of thing. And went on from there. And my dad used to drive me all over the UK doing all these seeding and ranking events, driving in the middle of the night to get us home and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, they supported me as much as they possibly could.
Whole family, and your younger sister Liz was a big supporter, and in 2007 you repaid her in a very special way.
Yes, she went down with cancer, and I became a bone marrow donor. I was actually a bone marrow donor anyway for the Anthony Lowland Trust, and I was on their register for quite a few years. And then my sister went down with it, and it turned out that me and my brother were the closest match. And my brother doesn't like hospitals and needles, so I said I would do it. So I gave my sister some bone marrow to help her survive. And then while I was recovering from that, I actually got a phone call from the Anthony Nolan Trust to say, there's another donor that needs your bone marrow. But unfortunately, you're not allowed to then give more bone marrow for at least a year after you've already given it. So I don't know what happened after that, because they never came back to me a year later. So I hope the other person found, you know, some more bone marrow and was able to survive.
Well, it's just nice you could do that for your sister. I mean, that is, you know, if anyone's going to be a match, you're going to hope it's going to be someone you know. And
that's right, especially just, family, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And how did she go?
Oh, she's fine. Yeah, she's okay now. She's still okay, and she's gone back to her teaching and everything else. So yeah, everything's fine. Everything's hunky dory in that respect.
Brilliant. You know, you talked about the camper van. You drove all over Europe competing in skiing competitions, and you slept in the van in the winter. Are you crazy?
Yes, that was very, very difficult. I had a Volkswagen Caravanette. And when my dad bought it for me, he actually drove out with me into Europe for the first time. And as we were driving through France, it was a national holiday. It was like a bank holiday in France. And a stone had been spat up from a lorry, and it smashed our windscreen. And we couldn't find a garage open because it was bank holiday. Everything was shut. So we drove for 200 miles at minus 10 degrees with no windscreen. And we had our hats and coats and scarves on as we were driving. And we managed to get to Germany, where it wasn't a bank holiday, and we managed to find a garage to fix the windscreen. And then I drove around Europe for, you know, for most of the winter, and it was great fun because I had a kettle and I could you know, boil water for a cup of tea and coffee and that kind of thing. But it did get a bit cold at night sometimes when it got down to minus 20 and you're trying to sleep in the back of this caravanette. It did get a bit cold.
But you snuck into hotels as well.
I did, yes. I used to, the bigger the hotel, the better, because they, although they had a reception area, they also used to have lots of little landings, you know, on the stairwell. And I used to find a sofa and sneak up there and lie on the sofa and go to sleep because it was nice and warm and things. And so long as, you know, either the manager, the duty manager, or the, you know, the people who go around, you know, cleaning rooms and doing all that kind of thing, so long as they didn't find me until, you know, early the next morning, you know, I could get 5 or 6 hours sleep. So, yeah, I used to do that by sneaking into big hotels and try and find somewhere to hide or with a sofa and curl up and go to sleep.
And you did sleep in some unusual places. You even checked into a mental hospital once.
I did, yes. I was in Finland, and I was training with the ski jumping team, the Finnish ski jumping team. They were jumping in Kuopio, but the hotels there were very, very expensive, and I couldn't afford it. But one of the trainers at the ski jumps was a painter and decorator, and he was working at the mental hospital, and he asked them if I could go and stay there, and they said yes. And so for a whole month, I stayed in Kuopio Mental Hospital while I was training out there, and my jumping went from strength to strength, and I think it was directly because I was living in this mental hospital. It was a very nice place to live.
It was nice. Did you interact with the other inmates?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, I did play with the staff because they have a big sports area, a big sports hall, and I used to play volleyball and football and all that kind of thing with them. But I met the inmates as well at breakfast in the morning. I'd meet the inmates and, you know, talk to them. And some of them were very nice people, and I wasn't quite sure why they were in this mental hospital. But it wasn't until a year later when I went back to Kuopio for a special competition that they told me that this mental hospital was Finland's equivalent to Broadmoor. And so, you know, I didn't know that I was sharing this hospital with some of Finland's top psychopaths and killers and worse. It was, you know, very unusual.
Now, you were a stunt skier as well. What kind of stunts were you doing?
I used to do lots of different things. When I started skiing at Gloucester, I was up there every weekend, all weekend, skiing away. And sometimes, if I was getting a bit bored, I'd ask my mate if I could jump over him. So he stood in a particular place on the slope, and then I would come down and use the natural bump on the slope and then jump over him. And then I jumped over two or three or four of my friends. And then I used to jump off the bottom of the slope, over the fence and into the car park. And then I jumped over cars and trucks and buses and all that kind of thing. And then when I was in Italy as a ski mechanic, I used to do a bit of teaching as well, and I used to teach a class, and then at the end of the week I would line them up and then I would jump over the whole class. And I used to do that every week, and then I started jumping over snow cats and all that kind of thing for a bit of fun. It was good laugh.
Then after a while you based yourself in the USA, Lake Placid in New York State. Why did you choose there?
Well, I was trying to race around Europe, but it was very, very expensive. And I thought America might be cheaper, you know, for things like hotels, B&Bs, and just cost of living. So I came home, worked with my dad in the building for a couple of months, saved up as much money as I could. I also had a tax rebate, which was very handy. It was like £1,200. And so I flew to New York, went up to Lake Placid, and started racing. But Lake Placid was just as expensive as Europe, and I ran out of money very, very quickly. So it was a question of either coming home or, you know, trying to stay in Lake Placid and look for something cheaper to do. And I saw the ski jumps, and I realized that Great Britain have had lots of alpine skiers, cross-country skiers, biathlon skiers, but we've never had a ski jumper. So I thought, I'll give it a go. And I thought, if I can crack this sport without cracking my bones in the process, I might be able to do something with it. So there was a bit of a gap in the market, and, you know, I went for it. And then 20 months later, I went to the Olympic Games in Calgary.
Now, the Hugh Jackman character in the film was made up, but you did have a mentor in Lake Placid, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I mean, I couldn't afford to have one coach on my way to Calgary. I just ski jumped with whatever team was around at the time. And I had about 20, 25 different coaches, ranging from 12 years old to 86 years old, and lots of different nationalities. But they couldn't put 20, 25 coaches in the film. So they put them all together and then put them into one character, which was Hugh Jackman and his character. So it was much easier, and I can see why they did that, because it would have been very, very confusing to have 20, 25 coaches. So, and the film really concentrated on my relationship with the coach, but it was actually my relationship with all 24, 25 of my coaches. But none of my coaches were as good looking as Hugh Jackman.
But was the one that stood out?
Yeah, I think there was. And the guy in Lake Placid was probably my favourite. He was a guy called John Viscomi. He was an Italian New Yorker. And he was about 75 years old at the time. And he was a lovely guy, really dry sense of humour. He used to come to the jumps in his pickup truck and watch me jump. And he used to give me some advice. And then he took me under his wing. He used to do a bit of, you know, DIY, handyman, all that kind of thing, a bit of gardening. And he introduced me to some of his clients. And then I ended up doing work with him, you know, doing handiwork, cutting grass and pruning and doing a bit of painting and decorating to get a bit of money so that I could stay in Lake Placid. And he was a lovely, lovely guy. Unfortunately, he died about, at least 10, 12 years ago. But he had the biggest effect on me as a ski jumper and as a person. You know, he really looked after me when I was in Lake Placid. He was a lovely, lovely man.
And he got to see you compete at the Olympics too. So
he did. He was gobsmacked when you know, he never thought that I would ever make it to the Olympic Games. And there he was, sat in his lounge watching Calgary at the Olympics. And then all of a sudden I came on, and he couldn't believe it that I actually made it to the Olympic Games. So he was very, very proud.
Well, the money did eventually run out in Lake Placid. You came home to Cheltenham. You worked as a plasterer and on sites again. Eventually, you ended up back in Europe. And that's where you took on the 90-metre jump. Talk me through your first time ski jumping from that height?
It was the most scariest thing I have ever done. And I was doing it in the summer, which is kind of worse, really, because at least if you do it in the winter, if there's a lot of snow, you haven't got so far to fall, because usually if there's a 3 foot of snow, you know, they take the snow off the takeoff, and then you've only got about 3 foot drop. But in the summer, I had to drop about 12 feet onto plastic. So it was very, very nerve-wracking. And I did my very first jump. I was jumping in Lake Placid on the 10, 15 and 40 metre. And then I went to Switzerland, a place called Kandersteg. And I jumped on the 60 metre and then up to the 90 metre. And it was one of the scariest things I've ever done. And I always knew the one thing that helped me to go down that 90 metre was that I always knew that I could do enough to land on my feet. And if I could land on my feet, even if I fell over afterwards, it didn't matter. The fact that I was landing on my feet rather than my head, and I thought I could survive. And that's what I did. Summoned up all my courage. I went down that 90 meter, took off. I only did about 30 meters, but I managed to land okay, and I didn't fall over. And after my first jump, I thought, well, that wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. And then I rushed back up to the top and did it again. And then within a couple of days, I was jumping down to about 70 metres. So I was really getting the hang of it very, very quickly.
And you managed to break the British ski jump record.
That's right. Well, we weren't sure what the British ski jump record was. I'd asked around from different people in Kandersteg, and they were saying, oh, I think the British record was 8 metres. And they said, no, I think it was 13 metres or no, 22 metres. And I jumped about 68 metres in Kandersteg. And so I wrote a letter to the British Ski Federation and said, hello, I'm Eddie Edwards. I've just been ski jumping in America in Kandersteg, and I just jumped 65, 68 metres. And I got the coach who witnessed it at the same time to sign as a witness, and then they gave me my jump license to jump for Great Britain in the European Cup, the World Cup, and then hopefully qualify for the World Championships and the Olympic Games.
Obviously, Eddie did qualify for the Olympic Games and came 58th out of 58 competitors in the ski jumping. But he also became a megastar. When he got back to Britain, his life completely changed. He made a lot of money. And then he lost it all. Only a few years later, he was declared bankrupt. And recently, he's had a rough time. He's been through a divorce. He told me that his wife wiped him out, took him for everything. He lost all his money, including the money he got from the rights to the film, Eddie the Eagle. He now lives in a house that has no ceilings, no walls, no kitchen. He cooks on a camping stove. The story of Eddie the Eagle after the Olympics is even more interesting than his incredible story that got him there. You'll hear that in part two of my chat with Eddie the Eagle in 2 weeks' time right here on London Calling. My guest next week is another Englishman who made it in America, Piff the Magic Dragon. You may have seen him on America's Got Talent. He's a grumpy bloke in a dragon suit. He's just celebrated 1 year at the Flamingo in Las Vegas, and he tours all over America as well. My guest next week, Piff the Magic Dragon. In the meantime, you can listen to more Mac Nuggets from me on my website, which is macmedia.co.uk. If you want to contact the show, I'm graham@macmedia.co.uk. You'll find me on Twitter, @GrahamMac, and it's spelt Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next week, I'm Graham Mac. This has been London Calling. Ta-da.